Okay, so the goal here is to talk about after one begins to detect gravitational waves, our ability to find out where they're from. In space, I'm not sure my title said that, but in fact I'm talking about space. There are two sorts of sources that we would be, I think, most interested in. One of these is binary stars in the galaxy. There we expect to see hundreds, maybe thousands of those to resolve those. There'd be some interest, I think, in telling where they are, the distance to them, how they're distributed. I think there's some interesting astrophysics from that. So there'd be an important reason to want to be able to not only detect the gravitational wave, but to know where the source is located, so we can do so we can get some astrophysics out of that. The other, I think, major source that will be of interest would be the coalescence of a binary massive black hole. There, maybe a priori, there's not a particular interest except you'd like to be able to point to things. But certainly, if you could determine which galaxy or quasar or some other sort of source this binary coalescence occurred in, then you would be very interested. So what I want to talk about are those two kinds of sources and how it is that a space detector could detect the position of these. And I'm going to talk about two types of detectors. I should mention that the work I'm doing is work that Tom Moore and I did. It was reported first a couple of years ago, and this is a slight update on that. Largely agrees with the work that Vecchio and Cutler have done with one minor additional wrinkle and with a slightly different approach to the modeling. So we considered two different configurations. One of these was like the Omega proposal, where you have satellites form an interferometer that are orbiting the Earth. The Earth is orbiting the Sun, but these satellites stay in the ecliptic plane. The other is a precessing plane configuration, which is the LISA model, where the orbits are such that the spacecraft, the detectors, stay in a plane which is inclined at 60 degrees to the ecliptic, and then that arrow remains pointing at the Sun, and that inclination sort of rotates rigidly around the Sun. And as I said, we were looking at two kinds of sources, low mass sources that would just be monochromatic binary stars, and then the massive black hole mergers. And should point out that our approach to both of these was to take a slow in spiral in the case of the black hole mergers, and so nothing exotic or elliptical, and to ignore the spin. And especially that's important, of course, in this case. So here is, in fact, what we modeled. And the basic idea, this is the response of the detector. H is a function of time. It depends on the two polarizations that are formed at the source, whichever the source is, and the form factors here of each detector to a wave of that polarization in a particular direction. And so these form factors depend on the location in the plane of the detector, which is theta, the polar angle in the plane of the detector, the azimuthal angle in the plane of the detector for the kth detector, and there are typically two of these in a triad of the three, and the polarization angle of the orbit, binary orbit on the sky. And then for the two cases here, the ecliptic plane case, the detector theta and phi were very simple because the detector remains in the ecliptic plane, so this is the same as the ecliptic position in this case. Theta and phi in the ecliptic plane. For the precessing plane case, and this is important to recognize, you get a much more complicated structure. You get something which is time dependent because the plane itself is precessing around, and that turns out to be an important thing to remember about these. So each of these depended on the amplitude of the source. And there was where we added a little something to what's been done in the past. We followed the result of Luc Blanchet's group and Willem Weissman's group, which put together a time waveform in the time domain to up to four halves post-Newtonian order. And there are two parts to this. One of them is the phase of the signal which is being sent from the binary, and that is developed to fourth order in chirp mass and other things. And this is the thing that both our that we and Cutler and Vecchio did, and that is to model this the phase of the signal, the function of time, out to fourth post-Newtonian order. But the one thing that we did, that Cutler and Vecchio did not, is to add to this the expansion of the waveform. That is, there are many higher order harmonics of the wave, and we included this, and they did not. And so this would be the zeroth order, the one half, the two halves, at each of the cross and plus polarizations. And what's interesting, I'd like you to notice the thing this depends on. So these amplitudes depend on the inclination of that binary orbit to the line of sight in the sky, as well as to some arbitrary initial phase that has to be determined by as you receive the signal. That is, it's a fairly complicated function. And that at the zeroth order versus the one-half order, you get a different combination of those parameters. So 1 minus cosine squared, pi, 5 plus cosine squared, cosine 2 psi, cosine psi. In addition, something that contributes to our sensitivity as well is the Doppler shift, the fact that as both of these detectors go around the sun, that there's a position-dependent modulation of the signal of the received phase. Phi is the received phase. This is the phase given off at the source, which depends on the period of the orbit around the sun and the size of the orbit, which we took to be 1 AU, appropriate for both of the proposed missions. And we also used a flat space model of the cosmology to model the position and the redshift of the source. So the overall plan here is to be able to predict what the signal would look like at the detector as a function of all these nine parameters. So the total mass, essentially the time to coalescence, which is just a parameter that characterizes the initial separation of the binary, the mass difference between the two components of the binary, the distance to the binary, the inclination of that orbit on the sky, the orientation of the orbit to the line of sight. So this affects the polarization of the gravitational waves that we're going to see, an arbitrary phase of where the orbit is at t equals zero, and then these two parameters, which are the things of primary interest, which is where is this source in the sky. As well, of course, we're interested in how far away it is, but those three things are the things we're interested in detecting, and we focused our efforts here on these two. So all of these things, in fact, have to be determined simultaneously, but the two that give us the position are the things we're interested in. The algorithm is a linear least squares, so it assumes that we have an initial pretty good position for each of these, and then we just want to use all the data to refine that and to see how accurately the final position can be determined. So what we did was take arbitrary values for all the parameters. In particular, we found that there was very little difference depending on the azimuthal angle in the ecliptic plane, but an important difference with regard to polar angle. So we tried a bunch of different values of theta. Then we saw how the detected H would vary with respect to each of the nine unknown parameters as a function of time, and then computed the uncertainties using the linear least squares covariance analysis, then turned that into an uncertainty in the solid angle, and then redid that again for lots of different parameters. Like I said, the main thing that we undertook was the sensitivity to position as a function of polar angle. We had a couple of ways to check this. We used the full four halves post-Newtonian code for everything. We could check this in the low frequency limit to a much simpler program that we also wrote for monochromatic binaries that did not chirp in phase at all. And as much as we could, we compared our results with Cutler and Vecchio's published results. So here is the result. Are those visible? That seems a little small. Can you see? Okay. for the monochromatic binaries. So these are those that are not chirping. They're just assumed to be a single frequency. what's shown here is the sensitivity in solid angle in steradians. So if you took a square root of that, you'd get the approximate sensitivity angle in radians. And here is a function of the polar angle. We did this at four different frequencies, starting with a tenth of a hertz up to a tenth of a millihertz. In each case, we adjusted the amplitude of the wave, that is, we put a binary at an appropriate mass and appropriate distance to give us this, so we would have a signal-to-noise ratio of about 10 within a detection bandwidth, so as to compare the two cases, as well as to have a standard comparison regardless of where we were looking. And of course, the amplitude had to change because of the change in the noise in the detectors in order to do that. So this tells us some interesting things. Maybe it's easiest to start here. At low frequency, it turns out that that the Doppler shift of the frequency will not move the frequency out of one frequency bin over the year. And so there is essentially no information on the position coming from the Doppler shift. And for the ecliptic plane case, that's the only way you can tell the position for those low frequencies. And so essentially it's blind to the position of binary stars at that frequency. The precessing plane case, the LISA case, because of the fact that that plane is changing, there's time dependence, which is position dependent, and so even at the very lowest frequencies, there is some information. Okay. Let me point out, however, that at this point, at this low frequency, none of them are particularly good, and that is the square root of this is about a tenth of a radian, and so that's not a real good definition in the sky, especially since at this frequency you expect to have a lot of sources, and the fact that there are a whole bunch of them roughly in that direction is not very interesting. however, at higher frequencies, at longer periods, this begins to decrease, and once again it doesn't go, it seems kind of constant here because the amplitude of the wave is changing as well. And actually, both systems then are able to get some information. And the point here is, once again, we're down at about a tenth of a radian. But the real interest lies between here and there. That is, we're looking for high-frequency binaries between... Oh, my goodness. Okay. No time left. She's trying to catch my attention for a long time, I'll bet. okay, I'll sum up real quickly. I'm sorry. Between here and there is where the interest is. And at this point, the uncertainty comes down to a few degrees, and that begins to be interesting. Let me just summarize for the coalescing black holes. Once again, because of the precessing plane at the very biggest black holes, therefore at the very lowest frequencies, these are microhertz, the sensitivity for without the precessing plane is basically not there. However, as the frequency increases and the Doppler begins to include some information, that drops. But another thing enters as well, and that is that even though these frequencies are well below, our lower frequency than we had in the last graph, one is still able to do a lot better. And the reason for that is somewhat interesting, and I'll end with that. And that is that because the higher order terms that we showed in the waveform code different combinations of the inclination and the initial phase angle, that breaks a degeneracy that you would not see if you didn't include those higher order terms. And so what we did was suppress those and run the same ecliptic plane case, and of course you're not able to see anything. But if you do include those, as you come down closer to the ecliptic plane, you find that the ability to see that effect and to be able to detect those signals and determine a position for that increases very strongly. However, the thing I'd like to point out is that we're still at a point where there's not enough sensitivity, which ought to be, as I understand, half a degree or so, to be able to tell for the coalescing binaries what galaxy we're in. And so that's a little disappointing that they can't be done, and it seems there's no particular way I can think of short of having a much more sensitive detector to accomplish that. Thanks. No, I didn't. For those, I ran through that very quickly. Yeah. So I assume, what I didn't get a chance to tell you because I was rushing was these were all. And now it's my fault for running late. These were all at a redshift of 1. Okay. And so then these are just the appropriate sizes. Thanks. Yeah.
That's what the signal noise ratio is giving. That's part of that.
Exactly. That's right. That's right. Because these are very bright. Yeah.
How does the setting plate often do when you turn off those other terms?
It doesn't matter. Because the degeneracy is already broken by the precessing plane. It's only for the ecliptic plane that it mattered. It was interesting to include it, but it didn't change anything. That's right. That's right.
Are there any other questions? Okay. Well, I think there are some announcements.